Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here. And from
New Hampshire Center for Cognitive and Behavioral Therapies, providing outpatient, evidence-based, specialty behavioral health and substance use disorder services. NHCCBT.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. What makes a New England stone wall so attractive, such an essential part of any classic image of our region? Well, here's what our guest today says. A stone wall mutely proclaims the stupendous tedium of hand labor endured by its creators and celebrates their stoic, ephemeral victory over the wilderness. We're talking this hour with Kevin Gardner, a stonewall builder, writer, and author of several books, including The Granite Kiss and now his latest, Stone Building, How to Make New England-Style Walls and Other Structures the Old Way. This hour in The Exchange, we climb around our state's stone walls to see how and why they're made in that old way. And we'll ask what stories those weathered rocks tell, because as Kevin's uncle always told him, the stones do speak. Join us. What questions or comments would you ask the stones or the stonewall builder? 1-800-892-6477. What have you always wondered about the stone walls in your area or that stone wall you stumbled across while you were out in the woods? Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Kevin Gardner, welcome back. It is great to see you. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks, Laura. It's terrific to be here.
Well, and I also want to let people know that Kevin brought in his own little stone wall. He built it here in the Exchange studio this morning. So if you want to see pictures of that, we will put some on our Facebook page and our website. So check it out. He is already mending the wall as we speak. Kevin, I want to start off this very New Hampshire-y conversation with a very New Hampshire-y poet, Robert Frost, and his poem, Mending Wall. Now, for those who don't know this poem, it's about two neighbors at spring wall mending time. We're not going to play the whole thing, but here's a little bit of Frost himself reading part of this poem where a classic line comes in.
I let my neighbor know beyond the hill, and on a day we meet to walk the line and set the wall between us once again. We keep the wall between us as we go. To each the boulders that have fallen, to each. And some are loaves, and some so nearly balls, we have to use a spell to make them balance. Stay where you are until our backs are turned. We wear our fingers rough with handling them. Oh, just another kind of outdoor game, one on a side. It comes to little more. There where it is, we do not need the wall. He is all pine, and I am apple orchard. My apple trees will never get across and eat the cones under his pines, I tell him. He only says, good fences make good neighbors.
Okay, so if you're wondering where that phrase comes from that you've probably used yourself, there it is, Robert Frost. I can't help but chuckle, Kevin. You know, my apples aren't going to eat your pine cones. If people want to hear the full audio of Robert Frost reading this poem on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. Also, other listeners have posted their favorite stonewall pictures, so you can post them on our website or on a Facebook page. If you've got one to share, go ahead. We'd love to see it. So, Kevin, you write in your books, including this new one, about the messages a stone wall sends to us today. We'll definitely talk about that. But what about to the colonists, Kevin? You know, those early folks who were sort of eking out a living in a scary, harsh landscape. What did the stone wall say to them?
Well, the first thing that stone wall said to them was nothing. Because they didn't begin their career building fences between sections of farmland by using stone. This is one of the reasons why we got so many of them so quickly. Their first choice of fencing was the great mess that you get when you have to cut down thousands of acres of virgin timber. And so earliest fences in most areas of New England during the days of settlement were made of stumps pulled out and lined up in great big forbidding rows, or more formally split rails that created a kind of zigzag fencing. But at the same time that they were doing this, they obviously discovered that we live in a remarkably stony part of the country.
That's so for sure.
The obligation to clear enormous amounts, not only of surface stone, but of stone that they hadn't realized was just under the surface, caused them to bring it out to the edges of these fields that were bound in by organic fencing and throw it up against those fences. When the clearing was more or less complete and they didn't have that kind of material anymore in large quantities, they simply began to reorganize the long, low mounds of stone that they had up against the old organic fencing. And that's how we began to get our stone walls.
So that's interesting. So the early, early fences that these settlers made were out of trees, and they were clearing the land for farming. Mm-hmm. And then they had the trees left over, so they made fences out of the trees. But as they tried to farm, they kept finding these rocks. And you put it so right, as a small-time gardener myself, you think, okay, I got all the stones off, and then you dig a little bit and you go, oh,
no, I didn't.
More stones. Right.
That's right.
So then they decided, all right, you know, life gives you lemons, let's make lemonade. Life is giving us stones, let's make stone walls.
It's true. It's true.
So what was the other message that it sent to them, Kevin, beyond this practical, you know, okay, here I am using what I've got in front of me. The idea that, and I'm quoting here from your book, the stone wall separated the safe, cleared space from the feral, threatening woods. The stone wall is the tamer, the wall of civilization. Talk a little bit about that, Kevin.
Well,
please.
I think you have to appreciate exactly what our earliest colonists faced when they came here. And you hear a lot of, you see a lot of things in writing of the period. And I'm talking now about the first half of the 17th century, the 1600s. It has to do with their relationship to what they found when they got here, which seemed to them to be what some of them called a howling wilderness, a great, awful, fearsome stretch of pure forest full of heathen Indians who were foreigners in every sense of the word, and so forth. And so to create little farms in the European style or British style on this land required that they tame it, that they somehow civilize it. And the civilizing influence of a stone wall, which is, or any kind of wall, is a sign of human habitation and therefore a sign of psychological and practical safety.
Right. It makes you feel like you've got some stake there, even though a threat could pretty easily step over a stone wall and still get at you. It makes you, it's a way to stake your claim in something hard and enduring like stone.
Yes, that's right.
You mentioned the British. Now, how did they approach stone walls? Because I think I read in one of your books, Kevin, that it's a little bit different. This idea of the small New England walled off, stone walled off farm is not quite what the Brits do.
Well, the model that was brought here for effective farmland was clearly a British model, and essentially it held that smallish fields produced best. This was mainly because all work was done by hand. And so you had a reasonable chance of sowing or plowing or cutting the hay on a piece that was 3 to 5 acres or even 1 to 2 acres than you did on the typical 10, 15, 20 acre fields that we now see. It was only when farming became mechanized in the 19th century that fields began to grow larger.
What about the idea of a commons, though? Sending your cows to munch on the grass at a commons. Did a stone wall put a stop to that?
It was part of the larger movement that had already begun in Great Britain by the time colonists arrived here, which goes by the name of enclosure, in which the old medieval system of lands held in common by all the members of a community began to give away to private ownership of particular tracts. They tried that here in Massachusetts Bay and down in the Plymouth area.
You've got the Boston Commons still, right?
That's right. We still have remnants of the idea in some of the names of places. However, in the United States at that time, there was so much land Well, it's all still there now, isn't it? But the enormity of the land made individual ownership much more attractive. And eventually, and it didn't take very long to do this, that common use of particular tracts gave way to the notion that every person could have their own spread, so to speak.
That's so interesting. So already this idea of grazing in a common place had fallen out of fashion, and the abundance of land and the abundance of stone made that even easier?
Yes. Yes, no question about it.
The number for you to join us as we talk about the history and the stories of stone walls, and a little bit later we'll get into some of the practicalities of actually building or repairing a wall, 1-800-892-6477. Here's your chance. If you've always wondered about the stone walls you see around you, we'd love to hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. By the way, Kevin Gardner is creating a mini stone wall in our studios as we speak. So if you want to check it out, you can look at Twitter or Instagram. Go ahead and check it out. We also have some photos on our Facebook page and our website that people sent in of stone walls. So check those out as well. Kevin, let's go to our listeners. And Dave's calling from Henniker. Hi, Dave. You're in the Exchange. Welcome.
Well, I'm glad to be there, Laura. First of all, Kevin, you do a terrific job of building stone walls, and you helped us separate out a garden from a lawn, and that's the kind of stone wall I'd love to have. Secondly, I was thinking of Robert Frost's poem, in which people tend to remember the part about good walls make good fences, good neighbors make good fences, or the other way around. But there's another phrase in there that I'd like people to remember, and that is that something there is that doesn't like a wall. And I think between neighbors, that's nice, because we tend to build walls to separate ourselves out from our neighbors or others, and that there's something that tries to push that down, which, of course, is gravity. And I like that analogy.
Well, Dave, you are the perfect caller today, because we should talk about that. I mean, that's another theme in this Frost poem. Something doesn't like a wall. And Dave, I'm going to play a little bit more of the poem that gets at that theme. So thank you so much for calling. Again, here's Robert Frost.
Spring is the mischief in me, and I wonder if I could put a notion in his head. Why do they make good neighbors? Isn't it where there are cows? But here there are no cows. Before I built a wall, I'd ask to know what I was walling in or walling out, and to whom I was like to give offense. Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that wants it down.
Something there is that doesn't love a wall. Again, that was Robert Frost. So what is it, Kevin, that something that doesn't love a wall? You write that there's actually a lot of somethings.
Yes, I think that Frost somewhat overstates the effect of Frost, including his own effect. But what's interesting to note about this is that, like all great poets, Frost is talking about more than one thing at the same time. I think one of the deftest lines in that poem is the phrase, "to whom I was like to give offense," which doesn't sound much different from "to whom I was like to give a fence." But Frost is not just talking about Frost itself, that phenomenon. He's also talking about the kinds of other things that set out to destroy walls the minute they're built, such as expanding tree roots or uneven compression from one part of the wall to another, or even bad building. One of the things that's little remarked on about mending wall is the fact that Frost and his neighbor are engaged in an annual chore, not a special event. And the type of wall that sits between Frost's old property down in East Derry and the property next door is called a single stack, a farmer style of wall. It's an exceptionally fragile type of wall that loses stones literally every single year because it's only one stone thick, and it's very easy for any kind of disturbance to push stones off it or to topple them from the peak of it. And although It's a little odd to see that type of wall built in New England, because one of the ancillary objectives of wall builders here was to use as much stone as possible. The speed with which they can be built and repaired made them attractive anyway.
Well, and so if you had a better wall, you wouldn't have to do what Robert Frost and his neighbor do, which is this annual spring rite where they go side by side on their sides of the wall and mending it.
Mm-hmm. Most walls need regular maintenance, and the fact that they haven't had it, so many of our antique walls, means that they're in relatively terrible shape. However, single-stack walls clearly need quite a bit more of it and more regular attention than other kinds.
Well, it did give Robert Frost fodder for a poem, so maybe it's good that it fell apart.
That alone made it worth it.
Let's take another call, Dave. Thank you so much for that one. The number for you to join us with your comments, questions about stone walls, old and new, here in New Hampshire, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange at nhpr.org. And Kevin, Peggy is in Center Harbor. Hi, Peggy. Thanks for coming on with us today.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My comment is, I've been living in New Hampshire since 1970, and I remember back then traveling the roads of New Hampshire. The stone walls were so beautiful and so visible wherever you went. And now they're very hard to see. I guess years of leaves falling and soil, and they're just getting covered up. And I really think that's sad.
Well, Peggy, this is a great question. And so she's been here for a good long time, Kevin. Used to see stone walls all the time. Now where are they?
Well, we think that our old stone walls tend to deteriorate from the top down, but Peggy makes a really good point, and that is that in reforested areas, they are losing height steadily from the bottom as well. If you dig away at the edges of an old stone wall that's been in the woods for 150 years, you can often find 1 or 2 feet of wall that has now hidden itself under the grade. And in fact, this is one
Wait,
of the...
Wait, 1 or 2 feet?
Oh,
under?
Yes. Well, you're talking
they
about...
They sink that far?
Sure. No, they're not sinking. They're getting buried by leaf fall and all the stuff that blows through the
sure.
woods, because they
right.
act in the woods like snow fences, except that they pick up everything that comes off the trees. And so, obviously, that rots down over time and simply builds the soil up against the walls themselves. Now, most of the old-timers, contrary to some rumors, built their walls directly on the ground. And so, of course, Laura, there was sinking, depending on how heavy the wall itself was and how soft the underlying soil was. But these walls are being hidden much more by the annual leaf fall that rots up against them.
Now, that's in the woods. What about mm-hmm. along the roadsides? Are stone walls being destroyed in some instances?
Well, there's no question that they're being pilfered. You know, the old weathered stones in our New England stone walls have become fantastically valuable as building material. This is a serious problem in many places, because it's very easy to just drive down some country road where no one's around and load up your truck with a whole bunch of nice-looking stones from any old wall you find, and then put them on the highway, drive down 95 to Florida, and sell them for astounding amounts of money to people who use them for fireplace facades and so on.
Wow. Well, Peggy, there you have it. Thanks for calling. This is The Exchange on NHPR. So, Kevin, what are your own thoughts about pilfering, borrowing, whatever you want to call it, you know, that material that you might see off on some, you know, remote road in the far northern reaches of New Hampshire?
Well, I think it's obviously disappointing and destructive of our heritage landscape, in a sense, too. Pilfer stone walls for crass commercial purposes elsewhere in New England. But I have to also say that I'm at least ambivalent about this, because as a restorer of antique walls, who often needs extra stone that matches the weathered aspect of the old stone in the walls that I'm working on, I am constantly looking for additional sources of extra stone. And there is only one place to get nice old weathered fieldstone, and that's out of old destroyed walls. So my purity as a defender of all the old wreckage of the New England agricultural landscape is somewhat complicated by that, because I have to dig into old walls to get the materials I need as well.
Well, go ahead.
Furthermore, there's a tradition here in New Hampshire that has been in force for a long, long time. And it's only the new attention to our old landscape that has caused this practice to become disreputable. And that is that, the tradition of people who actually build stone walls doing exactly the same thing that the pilferers are doing. In the old days, and I'm talking now about the 40s and 50s, when there were far fewer people out on these country roads and the new housing boom had not started, it was common practice for all stone wall builders to drive up and down the roads. This is how the man who taught me, my uncle, Derek Owen, was taught by the generations before him.
This is where you find your stones, Kevin.
That's right. That's right. And it
you
didn't
go and
matter.
Steal.
Well, it wasn't thought of as stealing.
I'm saying that to needle you.
No,
yeah,
it's true,
ahead.
Though. It's true. It is stealing, but it wasn't thought of that way. And so this this practice was quite common before it suddenly was deemed disreputable.
What do you call it? Igneous larceny?
Yes, I do. I'd call it
that
igneous
sounds larceny. Very fancy. And you know, you can kind of hide behind that and feel a little bit better about yourself.
Yes, that's right.
Well, you write about this in your book, The Ethics of Taking Stones from a Crumbling Wall that you might find by the roadside where it seems nobody lives. And in the book you ask, I'm quoting here, Kevin, if I take stone from a half-collapsed old wall that will never be restored to build a new one or refresh a deserving antique, am I committing robbery or renewal?
Absolutely.
And so how do you answer that question for
yourself? It depends on the situation. You know, when we go and plunder, if you will, old walls for the stones that we need, we always deal with the actual owner of the stones, either by paying them for it, or in some cases, you know, people are still removing stone walls to get them out of the way. And we can often find entire stretches of stone wall to purchase and take for use in our own projects.
So in that sense, maybe you pay a little bit less because somebody's building a new development and they don't want the stone wall there.
Yes, it happens. And you know what, Laura? Farmers in many places are still enlarging fields as well.
Well, you write, my predecessors here, who never hesitated to alter the landscape, recombine dismantled barns and houses, or move the church from one part of town to the other, would think my recycling as natural as rain. That's a quote from you, Kevin. So it's larceny or it's recycling. Depends on how you define it.
Yeah, and it also depends on how closely you want to look at the practices of our forebears here, who were entirely practical people and did not worry very much about how precious older things were, since in their own day there were very few old things around here.
Tell us a little bit more about your uncle, Owen. He's really, Derek Owen, he's the one who really got you into this.
Yeah, I went to work for him when I got out of school in the early 1970s. And he's a farmer. He's not a mason, but he has all those multiple skills that you have to have when you are the proprietor of a small New England farm. And one of them was that he knew how to build stone walls. He'd been taught in the 1930s and early 40s by older generations of men who knew what they were doing.
So out of necessity, it's not that he woke up and said, I want to be a stone wall builder. He said, I need to build a wall so that I can have my farm.
Well, he certainly applied his skills to his own farm where repairs were necessary on the old crumbling walls out there. At the same time, he discovered, and people in the area knew him for this, that there was a bit of a market for people who knew how to build stone walls, and that market was growing. It began to really expand in the late 1970s. And so from simple repairs of older walls for particular customers, we began to build new ones as well. And when we first started, we were essentially the only company in the immediate area that was doing this. But that rapidly changed.
All right, coming up, we'll talk more about that, including a younger generation getting involved in this venerable old tradition. And by the way, Kevin is building a stone wall as we speak on the air, so you can check out the pictures on Instagram and Twitter. It's the first time, I think, Kevin, that someone has actually built a stone wall while being interviewed. So I appreciate you for giving me a first there. We'll talk more in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the stories of stone walls with stone wall builder and author Kevin Gardner. We'd love your questions and comments on this. What have you always wondered about that stone wall that you see on your way to work, or that stone wall that you sometimes trip over when you go walking in the woods? Your questions and comments are welcome at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. So stonewalls is the topic this hour, but tomorrow in the exchange, we're going to be talking about concussions, and we'd love your help with that show as well. Given emerging research on contact sports and the young brain, are you reconsidering contact sports in light of this? Or do you think the concern is overdone and that the benefits of these sports far outweigh the risks? So let's get your thoughts on that, too, before tomorrow's show. You can send us an email, exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. So that little tumbling sound that you might have just heard is Kevin building a stone wall as we speak in our studios. Check out the pictures on Twitter and Instagram. And as I said, this is a first for the exchange, somebody actually building a stone wall on the radio. Kevin, let's go right back to our listeners and their questions about stone walls, their history, and so on. Rindy is calling in from Henniker. Hi, Rindy. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello. Kevin, well, Derek Owen came, and Kevin built our stone wall.
Great. Now, was it a brand new one, Rindy, or was it an old one?
No. I live in a house that was built in 1850. It's the old Bacon farm, and I was hoping John Bacon, he might come in the fall, because he doesn't drive anymore. He's 85 years old, but we used to, when we first moved to the house, years and years ago. Oh my goodness, I'm trying.
Don't guess, Randy. It'll just depress you.
Yes. Yeah, Derek came out, and then he just said, no, I'm going to have my nephew and his team of two crazy girls, Christine, and I'm trying to think, there was another person.
So, Rindy, what does the stone wall mean to you? Why even have a stone wall and spend the money that it takes to repair it?
You know something? It was something that we had to change the driveway when basically the house my oldest son was born in 1981.
So what about the wall, Rindy?
Okay, and so we moved.
Why did you feel like you didn't have cows or horses or anything, so did you really need it?
No, we lived in Antrim then, and then this house, the Bacon farm, through a bitter divorce, went on the market. And I went to school in Henniker, and back in the olden days, and worked, because I always had to work. I'm the only girl with five brothers. And so when I came up here to New Hampshire as a college student, I had a job. But then I ended up, my husband, I met him years later, and I said, no, I've always loved this farm because I used to walk. I never had a car.
Okay. And the stone wall was definitely part of that farm. Rindy, thank you for calling. So how would you assess that, Kevin? You know, if in this day and time when a lot of people don't have cows or horses or sheep, why even bother having a stone wall? Why not just let it crumble? Why repair it? What's it worth?
Well, there's a variety of reasons why people would want to do that. I think that maybe referring back to the poem is helpful, too. Frost himself points out that there's no practical value to the wall. But he also, certainly by implication, if not directly, establishes that the existence of the wall is extremely important to his sense of place. And it's important enough to make real effort. In the case of Rindy Routon, who was one of our very best customers over the years, what she wanted to do was define the front of her house, separate the lawn from the driveway, create a kind of portal entry for the place as a whole, because it wasn't obvious at the very beginning where those things ought to be or where they could be expected to be. So we built a major retaining wall for her, very long, that ran right around the edge of the driveway, and then set up some other freestanding walls to define garden areas in what had been a large, open, undifferentiated space. The walls themselves defined it, separated made it into separate areas and created uses for those areas by virtue of that.
Well, it kind of gets back to what we talked about earlier with the very early colonists. These walls help them say, this is my spot. I've cleared it. I've staked it out. And I feel a little bit safer and better here now that I have this stone wall.
Yeah, I think that concept still operates. It just operates now not in terms of the practicalities of farming, but in terms of the aesthetics of landscaping. That has been the big shift in New England stone walls from one emphasis to another over the years.
Well, Rindy, thank you for the call. By the way, how did the Native Americans feel about these stone walls popping up all over the place?
This might surprise you, Laura, but Native Americans had a reputation as exceptionally skillful stone wall builders, and they spent quite a lot of time building them.
For themselves or for the colonists?
Not for themselves, because, of course, they didn't run grazing animals.
Right,
so
exactly.
So had no need of permanent barriers, but they did build things out of stones. They built ritual constructions that had various spiritual or political meanings. They also built practical structures from time to time for food storage in areas that they were going to only be occupying seasonally and then leave and come back. And they built things like the extraordinary causeway across a lake up in Wakefield, New Hampshire, a beautiful causeway that connected two ends of a trail that terminated at the shores of this lake. And in order to keep themselves from having to walk all the way around the lake on a trail they used habitually, they built a causeway all the way across it, just about a foot below the surface of the water, so that you could easily wade across the lake, but it did not divide the lake environmentally in terms of the fish and other creatures, and it also could not be seen unless you knew it was there.
That is ingenious.
Isn't that great?
Yeah, and in the book, you also talk about other stone structures. So, Kevin, we'll talk about that maybe a little bit later for sure. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Our guest today in the exchange, Kevin Gardner, a stone wall builder who designs and restores traditional New England-style stone walls. He's the author of several books on the subject, including the latest, Stone Building, How to Make New England-Style Walls and Other Structures the Old Way. He'll be speaking tonight, by the way, at the Concord Public Library at 6 p.m. He is sort of constructing a wall in our studios as we speak, so you can check out Instagram and Twitter if you'd like to see that. Back to our listeners, Kevin, and Susan's in Manchester. Hi, Susan. You're on the exchange. Go ahead.
Hi. I grew up in eastern Connecticut, where my parents had a property with stone walls that were on the along the sides of rural roads. And my father did a lot of rebuilding of stone walls over maybe a 30-year period. His feeling was that a lot of the roads were widened during the Depression era, and the stone walls had to be moved so that the roads could be made wider. And it was a lot of work was done by the CCC, or the Civilian Conservation Corps. And they just kind of threw the stone walls, you know, aside to prepare for the widening of the road. And I wonder if that was a phenomenon that also took place in New Hampshire.
That's interesting. It kind of gets back, Kevin, to our earlier caller's question about, you know, where did all the stone walls that she used to see go? Thank you so much, Susan, for the question. Go ahead, Kevin.
Well, she's exactly right. The CCC was involved in efforts like that, but they also did some work in areas that were recreational in nature, up at Lost River, for instance, in New Hampshire, and other places like that, where they were sometimes restoring some of the older walls. But Susan's right that CCC members were not necessarily highly skilled in the techniques of rebuilding stone walls, and I don't think they were especially concerned either during those days with preserving what might be called the specific character of any given wall. To them, at that time, they were simply collections of stones that had to be moved from one place to another. But she's right that there was a fairly profound mark on a lot of the older walls that way by rebuilding during that particular era.
That's interesting. Yeah. So stone walls were largely by the CCC taken down, in some instances put up, Kevin?
Yes. The CCC was employed with for whatever purposes were deemed necessary in any given area. You know, the CCC was not formed to create specific projects. It was formed to keep young men busy during the Depression. on various projects that could be thought of as beneficial to the population at large. But preserving historical stone walls was not really their objective.
Well, our caller talked about Connecticut, and I have an email here from Christopher in Manchester about other New England states. So thank you to both of you. Christopher says, I'm interested in regional differences of stonewall styles within New England. Where my niece lives in eastern Rhode Island, the walls are ubiquitous, but the rocks are quite flat, narrow, and rectangular, and quite high. Are there differences between the other New England states? And where do the walls, quote, begin as you're traveling into the New England states? Are the rocks and walls less plentiful, perhaps in certain parts of New England? Christopher says, we seem to be blessed by classic stone walls in central and southern New Hampshire. Christopher, it's a great question, and one I had too. Regional differences, Kevin.
Regional differences are the result of two phenomena. One is the whatever the predominant stone is in that area. And so what Christopher has to say about the differences in the way, for instance, stone walls in eastern Rhode Island look, that's entirely correct, that it is because the stone there is that way. But, you know, we have an exceptionally violent and varied geological history here in New Hampshire and in New England as a whole. And it was not an equal opportunity kind of set of phenomena, from tectonic collisions to volcanic activity to the four separate periods of glaciation that put walls of ice a mile high right on top of where we all live now and ground up the Green and the White Mountains, which were once higher than the Himalayas and have now been busted up into a million little pieces and respread all over New England.
Wait, the White Mountains were once higher than the Himalayas? I didn't know
they
that.
They were huge.
Is New Hampshire stonier than most other New England states? Because it seems like, well, we're the Granite State, first of all. It seems like Vermont has more of that gentle, pastoral, you know, easier to work with farmland than we do. So are we especially blessed with stones for stone walls?
We're quite blessed, if that's what you want to call it.
Yeah, early farmers probably didn't feel blessed, but yeah.
Not always an actual practical blessing. I don't know if we're stony or not. One thing you have to remember about Vermont is that, largely speaking, it was settled 75 to 100 years later than most of New Hampshire, except right along the rivers. And so the amount of time that they had to create the network of stone walls over there, while it was substantial, and they've got more than their share, is a little bit less than what we had here in New Hampshire. So New Hampshire may appear to be stonier than Vermont, but it's not. In basic terms.
We have a couple emails, Kevin, following up on our conversation about how Native Americans used stone and felt about the colonists' stone walls. One listener says, I have heard of a great stone wall that the Abenaki built to defend themselves from an invading tribe at the south end of Lake Winnesquam. This person says, how common was it for Native people to build walls, and how did they use them? And I think you did answer that, Kevin, earlier. Here's another email from BJ in Canterbury, who says, perhaps you said this, but the stone wall as an expression of safety or civilization came at the expense of a wiped out previous civilization. Watching the forests be leveled must have been particularly painful for them. So thank you to both of those emails. And is there anything else, Kevin, that you want to add on that Native American angle to this stonewall conversation? I know you talked about that a fair bit.
One of the places in this region where the stone walls, and I think one of your correspondents pointed this out, is in southern Rhode Island and Connecticut, where stone walls got started much, much earlier than in many other parts of New England. I'm talking now about towns down on those rocky promontories at the southern end of Rhode Island, towns like Tiverton and Little Compton and so forth. This is a part of New England where the original dimensions of our old stone walls and also their configurations are preserved rather more carefully than they are in other parts of New England. And they're beautiful walls. Many of them were built by Native Americans prior to King Philip's War. In the 17th century, Native Americans had a sterling reputation as stone wall builders, but not for themselves. They built stone walls for pay. They built them as indentured servants. They built them as punishment by colonial-era courts for various real or perceived infractions. But because they were so skillful at working with native materials, they very quickly became known as exceptionally talented wall builders, and a great many of the walls they built are still standing.
Wow. Well, there you have it. Thank you again to both of those folks for asking about that. This is The Exchange on NHPR. Kevin, here's another email that came in. This is a person, let's see, didn't give a name. First settlement in New Hampshire, Odeorn Point in Rye, has miles of stone walls, each its own wonder. Could some be the first walls of New Hampshire, too? Wow.
I can't say it's impossible. The seacoast obviously was the first point of settlement here.
Right.
The earliest stone wall we have some indication of was built in Sagadahoc, Maine in 1607. But it was part of the failed attempt to create a permanent colony up there. And we only have a reference to it in a letter. It's probably best to stay with the 1640s or so as the time when stone walls really began to be constructed.
Here's another email from Michael who says, Kevin might want to mention Dan the Stone Man Scroth from Pittsfield, New Hampshire. Dan is a stonewall enthusiast and has built hundreds of walls for the local communities and has brought people together who otherwise wouldn't to help build these stone walls. Michael says, I want to give a shout out to Dan for his countless hours volunteering to build and restore these historic stone walls. So thank you for that, Michael. And, you know, Kevin, here's the question that that raises for me. You told me before we started talking on the air this morning that there's a whole generation of people now who are actually interested in doing this.
Well, there's no question that we are in the midst of what can be described as a Stonewall Renaissance. You know, this began in the late 1970s when the seemingly permanent residential construction building boom began around here. It's been up and down since then, but it hasn't really abated. And that brought with it a demand for landscape services that has really beefed up the Stonewall industry, if you can call it that. There are a great many people now, probably more learning to do this and doing it both on a professional and an avocational basis than have been for at least the last century, if not longer.
Let's take another call. And Jed's in Madbury. Hi, Jed. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Sure can. Go ahead.
Yes. I grew up in Washington, New Hampshire, and this story is actually really touching to me because I used to do lots of cross-country skiing and hiking out in the woods in western New Hampshire. And you could get, you know, 5-10 miles into the woods, and there would be these stone walls. And I finally, like, asked my mom, like, well, where did these walls come from? And she said that the whole entire town used to be fields. And then as the fields were taken over by woods, that's what's left over is the foundations and the stone walls out in the woods. Sorry, I'm breathing heavy. I was just running plywood up the roof.
Be careful, Jed. I hope you're not on the roof now.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I am. So with growing up and seeing these walls and cross-country skiing through the New Hampshire wilderness, I really got to love the walls. And then I came to move to Nadbury, New Hampshire, and we bought a property. And the north, it's 2.8 acres. The north side has an old stone wall. The west side has an old stone wall. And then it also has split rocks where farmers had drilled the rocks and split them for foundations.
Right, so, to help build their homes. Jed, I got to cut you off because we're heading into a break, but we will talk about the ubiquity of stone walls and how we stumble over them and what that tells us about our history. So thank you so much for calling in. More with Kevin Gardner and stone walls in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
Keep NHPR in the loop. If you're a sustainer and you've received a new credit card, take a moment to update your payment information. Better yet, switch your sustainer payments to your checking account so you never have to update expired or replaced cards again. Giving as a sustainer for just $10 or $15 a month is the easiest and most powerful way to support the station that keeps New Hampshire connected. Update your information easily at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, a stone wall builder who designs and restores traditional New England-style stone walls. Kevin Gardner is with us. He's also the author of several books on the subject, including the latest that we're talking about, Stone Building, How to Make New England-Style Walls and Other Structures the Old Way. Kevin will be speaking tonight at the Concord Public Library at 6 p.m. We also have lots of photos on our website by Edith Currier of Stone Walls in New Hampshire and of Kevin's work. Send us your pictures of your favorite stone structures. Post them on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. Also on Twitter and Instagram, you can see pictures of Kevin, who is building a mini stone wall in our studios right now as we speak. So check those out as well. Kevin, you know, for a lot of people, they first start to wonder about these stone walls, not when they're driving to work or riding their bicycle, but when they're hiking or cross-country skiing in the woods and they bump into it, they stumble into it. Not just the wall, but the foundations of houses as well. It's kind of ghostly, isn't it? What is that sort of speak to you?
This is one of those things that is fascinating to talk to people, but sometimes you get a kind of look of, I don't really believe you, from them. Visitors to our state often say, why'd they build all these walls in the woods? and they are somewhat skeptical sometimes when you tell them that the woods once weren't there. But it's very difficult to explain to people that the stone walls in our woods are actually older than the woods, and that there was a time in the early part of the 19th century when New Hampshire and most of New England was virtually cleared flat for farming. It looked more like the Lake District of Great Britain or someplace like that, where the entire landscape was a patchwork of fields and little villages. We were spread much more evenly over the landscape in those days, instead of clustering in villages and cul-de-sacs and so on. In fact, there are a great many towns in New England, especially in upland areas, that have fewer people living in them today than they did in 1830.
Well, and it is shocking, though, and it just speaks to me about the incredible regenerative power of nature, that to see these stone walls, you know, literally miles and miles out in the woods, to think that the forest wasn't there. It grew back so quickly.
Anybody who is my age, and I'm in my mid-60s now, and has lived here all their lives, is well aware that there was a lot of open space in the 1950s and 60s that isn't there anymore. It takes next to no time for the woods to return if they are allowed to do so. There are fields in my own neighborhood, which were grassy hay fields when I was 10 years old, and now have 30 and 40 foot trees in them.
Well, it's funny what you say about tourists coming here and saying, why'd you build stone walls in the middle of the woods? But I understand the sentiment. Let's go back to our listeners, and Ed is in Keene. Hi, Ed. Thanks for calling in. Go ahead. You're on the air. Ed, are you there? Hey, Ed, we're having a hard time hearing you. Are you there?
How about now?
It's not great, Ed. I would encourage you to call us back. I'm having a little bit of a hard time hearing you there. But thank you, Ed, for trying, and do try back. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You know, Kevin, you said earlier that we're in the midst of a renaissance of interest in stone wall building. So younger people are interested in doing what you and your family have done for a long time and what people way, way, way back did. How different is it, Kevin, building a stone wall today versus, you know, the early first stone wall builders?
Well, we're not. The difference is the absence of necessity. We're not desperate to have fences anymore. We build our stone walls for decorative purposes or for historic restoration purposes. The rules or the technical requirements of building stone walls are precisely the same today as they were 10,000 years ago. It has not changed at all. This is one reason why it's so difficult to tell the age of a wall simply by looking at it, because those styles, the basic styles, don't change very much.
Wait, the rules haven't changed from 10,000 years.
Mm-mm.
So what are the basic rules? It's nice to know that things haven't changed.
Essentially, yes, it is, isn't it? They essentially involve making sure that every single stone in every wall that you build has multiple physical dependencies to hold its position rather than only one. Because stone walls move around so much, because they are subject to so many natural forces that are trying to take them apart, it is better for each stone in the wall to have more than one way to stay where it is as long as it can. And this means essentially for them to be touching as many other stones within that structure as they possibly can. Stone walls that have only one other stone, in other words, stone walls in which the individual stones are piled up directly on top of each other rather than cross-hatched over several other stones with the same kind of cross-hatching happening above them as well, have a much less secure chance of lasting as long as they can.
Kind of sounds like the advice that you have, you know, have a couple friends that you can depend on, not just one person.
That's a beautiful analogy.
Well, and again, Kevin is building a stone wall as we speak in our studio, so you can check it out on Twitter or Instagram. So back to this point about how you build it, and the best thing is to have several edges of each individual stone, depending on the edges of other stones. So this is dry masonry, Kevin. In other words, no cement, no filler. Mm-hmm. What are the advantages of that?
There are several. One is ease of construction, of course. One is less expense. You know, our original stone walls were built without any mortar because mortar was not only time-consuming and tedious to create in those days, but even after they started putting Portland cement in it in the latter part of the 19th century, a dry-laid wall is not only easier to fix, but it also sheds water, does not collect it as masonry walls do, and therefore combines ease of construction with ease of maintenance.
So it doesn't crack because it already has cracks in it.
That's right. It's nothing but cracks.
And it adapts to shifts in the landscape, frost and you know, heating and cooling and trucks rumbling by, and that disturbs them a little bit, but because they're built sort of jiggly, they're able to handle the jiggles.
A well-built dry-laid stone wall has a certain amount of flexibility to it. It can respond to changes in the ground underneath it or to semi-catastrophic events without falling down, even though it loosens up a little bit.
Minor earthquakes and so forth, which
That's
we have
right.
had here in New England.
Oh, yes, we do.
Let's take another call. This is Karen in Brookline. Go ahead, Karen. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. I had a question. I lived in Windham for a few years, and one of my neighbors was trying to build an addition, and they were trying to move their rock wall, and they were told that they couldn't because the rock wall was built by Chinese laborers, and it was historic.
Wow. This is a great question because it does make me wonder who built these walls. I mean, we're used to thinking of the farmer, maybe his or her family. We also talked about Native Americans, how they built a lot of these walls, mm-hmm. but go ahead. Immigrant laborers.
I don't know what authority Karen is citing when she says that it was not allowed to change this wall. We have very few, if any, serious protections for our old stone walls. We have some. We have a couple of laws here in New Hampshire. One says you can't move materials from somebody else's land, and therefore you can't steal walls. And another makes it a misdemeanor to break the bounds between two properties that are owned by different people. But both of these are not explicit as far as stone walls go. So I'm not sure what rule or law Karen is citing when she says that the folks were not allowed to move a particular wall because of who it had been built by. That's not a general protection that we have here. And so it sounds more like a local ordinance or a historic district rule or something like that.
Sure. Well, that makes sense, actually. And I'm guessing that towns do have different rules and regs around keeping their stone walls because they're part of what make the town pretty.
They do sometimes, but Laura, you know, it's very difficult, especially in independent-minded New England, to tell people what they can do with their own property. The vast majority of our old stone walls are in private hands.
She mentioned Chinese immigrants building these walls, and you do mm-hmm. mention in one of your books, Kevin, that in later times, immigrants were known as skilled wall builders.
Well, there's no question that from the mid-19th century on, we had enormous numbers of people coming over here from countries in which stone wall building was a recognized profession. I'm talking now about Greece, Ireland, Italy, Finland. Many of those people showed up in the middle of the 19th century, and although the farmers were no longer building many, many walls by that time, others were. The railroads needed infrastructure, municipalities were building walls around reservoirs and cemeteries and so on, and the wealthy, who were sometimes buying up old farms out in the countryside, also employed wall builders at places like Castle in the Clouds or the Rocks up in Bethlehem.
Okay, well, thank you for that call. You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR. Kevin, speaking of wall builders from other countries, I've got an email here from Liz, who says, while traveling on the windswept west coast of Ireland, we noticed that the ancient stone walls on the hill sites had open spaces between the stones. Asking a local why this was, we were told that it allows the winds to blow through and keeps the walls from crumbling. Liz asks, is this done on higher elevation and or windswept areas in New England? Liz emailing us from North Conway. Thank you, Liz. Go ahead, Kevin.
It certainly is. On Nantucket, for instance, where the wind blows rather constantly, they build what they call lace walls, which have
lace walls,
deliberate holes in them, and just the way the banners that they put up outside stores have little scoop cuts in them to let the wind pressure through so they won't blow all over the place. It's precisely the same with walls. And this is usually done only with, however, single stack type walls that are much more fragile and actually can lose stones to a wind.
Here's another question. Again, talking about walls on coastal areas. John says they used stone as ballast for the schooners and packets that transported goods throughout the colonies. The port towns along the New England coast all have beautiful stone walls. So that's something else we haven't talked about. We talked about farmers building stone walls out of the stuff that they hauled out of the ground so they could plant. But John's right. There were some rocks coming over from Europe that were probably used along the coast.
Sure. I'm sure there's no question about it.
John, thank you for that email. The phone number is 1-800-892-6477. And by the way, Kevin Gardner is almost done building the stone wall that he started out building when we started our conversation. You can see his wall building on Instagram at NHPR Exchange. By the way, we always post some fun stuff on Instagram. So check it out, NHPR Exchange. Kevin, last question for you. When you travel around New Hampshire, you know, on your bike, in your car, walking, do you even see the houses or the forests, or do you just see the stone?
You know, it's a phenomenon of stone walls, Laura,
right?
That once you begin to notice them, you can't stop.
Sure.
There's a kind of almost hypnotic attraction to them. And this is for many people, not just people like me. What I see when I drive around New Hampshire is not necessarily walls alone, but rather the outlines of the older landscape that gave rise to the walls. That's what I like to look for.
What do you mean by that, the outlines of the older landscape?
I mean, I try to see a landscape without its modern appurtenances, without the regrowth of the forest. I can use the walls and their shapes, their configurations to imagine what it was like when the walls were new, how much open space there was, where the real old houses are or were, as opposed to all the new houses that have been put into the little spaces in between in the meantime. So
it's like it helps you time travel.
Absolutely.
Helps you figure out what the landscape looked like.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, so you've got about 8 more stones, Kevin, and less than 60 seconds, so no pressure. But
I can do it.
If you want to see Kevin building his stone wall in our studios, really fun. It's on Instagram, NHPR Exchange. Kevin, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh,
I really, really appreciate
such
it.
Such a pleasure, Laura. Thank you.
Again, that's Kevin Gardner, stonewall builder and writer. His latest book, Stone Building, How to Make New England Style Walls and Structures the Old Way. If you live in the Concord area, he'll be speaking at the Concord Public Library tonight at 6 p.m. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
You've been listening to The Exchange on the Special Pledge Free Stream on NHPR.org. Special thanks to our sustaining members for your regular and continuous support of the station that keeps New Hampshire connected to itself and the world. Coming up, it's 1A Uninterrupted, thanks to your support. Civics 101 is a podcast that wonders about things you might have learned in school but have since forgotten, like what does a White House chief of staff actually do and how does gerrymandering work? And NHPR's Civics 101, your guide to what you need to know. Subscribe to this and all of NHPR's podcast.
The news doesn't stop between Morning Edition and All Things Considered. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson, co-hosts for Here and Now,
your source for comprehensive news, information, and interviews in the middle of your day.
We're combining the resources of NPR and WBUR Boston to bring you stories that will keep you up to date.
Entertain you with features and music.
Join us Here and Now.
Here and Now, weekdays from noon till 2 on NHPR. NHPR is a vital part of your day throughout the day. We thank you for your sustaining membership with this special pledge-free stream on NHPR.org. Outside In is a podcast about the natural world and how we use it. You don't have to be a keen kayaker, a compulsive composter, or a breathless biologist to love Outside In. It's a show for anyone who's ever been outdoors. Subscribe to this and all of NHPR's podcasts. You're listening to the special pledge-free stream on NHPR.org.